Bob also passed away in 2012 at the age of 90, but worked until the last, serving as swordmaster for Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. There was no Google back then, and in hindsight, I almost think it was better that I was blissfully unaware of the incredible reputations of the two men with whom I would be training. Had I known of their backgrounds, I might have been completely intimidated. But I was curious about the man I would be dueling with. Over drinks after the first table read, I had started to get to know Mandy a little. At some point, the conversation naturally turned to the subject of sword fighting and the preparation we'd both be expected to endure prior to filming. I casually asked him if he had any experience with fencing. He sort of frowned a little, in much the same way Inigo Montoya might have done, and said, "Not really." I breathed a sigh of relief. "Neither have I, really. Just a little at acting school, but I don't remember any of it," I told him. I figured we'd be going in raw, the two of us. It was only later on that I discovered that he had been training for 2 months in the U.S. and was thus already way ahead of me in the process.
Mandy Patinkin. Goldman wrote in the introduction to my character that he is the world's greatest sword fighter, and I figured that's what I've got to learn how to do. So I immediately got in touch with Henry Harutunian, who was the Yale fencing coach, and we worked together for 2 months. He taught me the basics of fencing. I was a righty, and he taught me first how to fence with my left hand. We worked the left before the right, and I actually became a better left-handed fencer than a right-handed fencer.
Looking back, I do believe he was sizing me up from the moment we shook hands, trying to determine if I was someone he could beat. That's the funny thing about acting. It can be collegial and collaborative, but it can also be intensely competitive. A healthy competition between actors is never a bad thing. As actors, you work together, but you also try to push each other, bring out the best in each other. I knew I would not only have to bring my A game as an actor on this film, but I also had to be on my toes in the duel with this guy. We would, after all, be using swords on the day, not the protected rapiers we would be practicing with.
Mandy Patinkin. It was 1986. My father died in 1972. I read that script, and I wanted to play Inigo because my mind immediately went, if I can get that six-fingered man, then I'll have my father back in my imaginary world. He'll be alive in my imagination. So that was it for me. It was like, I'll become the greatest sword fighter, and my reward will not be to be in this movie that ended up being what it's become to all these people. My reward will be that my father will come back. Rob Reiner.
I'm sure there was a sense of competition between Carrie and Mandy, and I think that was probably healthy. I mean, this is a duel to the death, supposedly, and so it is a competition. I think that was there for sure.
Having gotten to know Mandy a bit, I can safely say with some assurance that Inigo Montoya was indeed the perfect role for him. He was born to play it. Like Inigo, Mandy was passionate and ambitious, if not a little competitive. Even today, when you watch him perform, you can tell that here is an actor who still has splinters in his feet from all the years treading the boards on Broadway. That is where he honed his confidence and professionalism, from performing live on a stage literally thousands of times. And there's no question that some of the best actors have honed their skills in the theater. Mandy certainly fell into that category. By the time I met him, he'd already been established as a uniquely versatile performer, having starred not only in Ragtime, but also in Yentl, for which he was nominated for a Golden Globe. He'd also received a Tony Award for his role as Che Guevara in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita in 1979. You don't build a body of work like that without a significant degree of talent and ambition. Mandy had both in abundance.
Mandy Patinkin. I remember Rob saying to me that these guys, meaning the characters in the film, are holding poker hands, but they just kind of hide it. Then he held up an imaginary hand of cards at the table and sort of turned his hand around as though he was hiding the cards in his pocket, and he said, "Every now and then, one of these guys shows his cards." And I remember that image of hiding your hand and letting one of the cards peek out every now and then, meaning a smile or something that you were hiding. The sense of humor about it, a little bit of tongue-in-cheekness. Rob Reiner.
Mandy is a great actor, but you know, every actor is insecure. I didn't see Carrie's insecurity, but he obviously had it. I don't know any actor that isn't insecure. With Mandy, though, at that time, he would carry his insecurities on his sleeve. It would be out there. He had done Evita and Sunday in the Park with George. He had won a Tony, and he's a brilliant actor, extremely talented, but he'd worked on Heartburn, and they'd replaced him with Jack Nicholson, and he was all worried that he wasn't going to do well in The Princess Bride. He wanted it to be perfect, and after one of the first days of shooting, I went into the trailer with him and I said, "Mandy, you don't have to do anything. You are so talented, you don't have to try. Just get out of your own way. You've got great words to say, you're a brilliant actor, and you just let them come out and you're going to be great." And from then on, he was cool.
Looking back, it's hard to imagine anyone else playing Inigo Montoya. He seized the role and made it his own, embracing it with a zeal and intensity that would have made the Montoya family proud. So I had a formidable foe in Inigo. That much was obvious from the moment we began training for the dueling sequence, which for us began almost immediately. The very next morning after the table reading, I got a very early call from one of the trainers. "Good morning, Carrie. This is Peter Diamond," came the voice on the other end. "Are you ready to do some sword fighting?" "Absolutely," I said enthusiastically, if a little groggily. "I have to ask before we start, have you had any training?" I shared once again about my amateur skills honed at acting school. "Do you remember any of it?" "No, not really." "Right, that's no problem. Probably better, actually," came the response. "What do I need to bring?" I inquired. "Sweats, sneakers, and a t-shirt," he said. "That's it? Nothing else?" "Nope, just be ready to work. We'll break for a quick lunch, but basically we're going to be training from 9 to 5, 5 days a week." I thought about that for a moment. 8 hours a day? That meant 40 hours a week. "Seriously?" I asked half-jokingly. There was a pause on the other end of the line. "Oh yes, Carrie, we've got a lot of work to do," he replied in a no-nonsense manner. "We start tomorrow bright and early, 9 a.m. sharp." He then gave me the details of where to meet. I jotted it down on a notepad. We said our goodbyes, and I hung up the phone. I had no idea what to expect. I still hadn't figured out that he and Bob Anderson were not merely stuntmen, but the finest sword trainers available. Nor had I fully grasped the concept of a 40-hour work week devoted entirely to becoming proficient in an athletic endeavor. To put it mildly, it was a little more than I had bargained for. The next day, I arrived promptly at 9 a.m. as requested, at a dance studio the production had rented for us off Oxford Street in Soho. As I walked through the door, I immediately noticed that Mandy was already there, sword in hand, his breathing labored, and his face glistening with sweat. It was obvious he had been there for some time. "Damn you, Inigo." I introduced myself to Peter and Bob. In all candor, my first thought was, wow, they really picked some old-timers to work with us. But boy, was I wrong. At 5'6", Peter may have been a short, barrel-chested man with thick arms, big hands, rosy cheeks, and an easy, jovial smile. But at 57, he was still in peak physical condition and tough as nails, too. He had an air of athleticism and physicality. You just knew that he could take care of himself in almost any situation and could easily disarm anybody within a nanosecond, with or without a weapon in his hand. I once saw him demonstrate this in a bar, all the while holding a beer in one hand without spilling a drop. By contrast, physically, Bob was tall and lithe, perhaps 6 feet, and equally impressive, but in a different sort of way. He had the stature that you'd expect in a fencer, and even at the age of 64, he was just as light on his feet as Peter, and as insanely flexible and proficient with a blade. Both were fitter than most men less than half their ages, which was precisely my demographic. Nervous much? Bob proceeded to explain to Mandy and me that the most efficient use of his and Peter's time would be to split their tutorial efforts. I would be working with Peter, while Mandy would be working with him. He then asked me a few basic questions about fencing and swordsmanship, none of which I could answer. Mandy, it turns out, could, having already started his training in the U.S. "Damn you again, Inigo." "Okay," Peter said. "Both of you pick up a sword. First things first, you need to know how to hold it properly." We did as instructed. I looked out of the corner of my eye at Mandy, who clearly appeared far more comfortable than I did. Like this, Peter said, demonstrating to both of us, but looking at me. Not too tightly, not too lightly, is the phrase to remember. He adjusted my grip. The sword, a light rapier, felt foreign in my hand, and surprisingly awkward. Think of it like you're holding a bird in your hand, Peter said. If you hold it too tightly, you'll strangle it. Too loosely, and it'll fly away. Then, as if to prove his point, Peter tapped my sword faster than lightning with his blade. So fast, I barely saw it move, causing it to fall out of my hand and land with a clatter on the floor. See? He said with a smile. Yes. The answer, of course, was really no. I hadn't even seen it coming. I was instantly transfixed by the skill and expertise of these guys. I only hoped that I could live up to their expectations. Peter then adjusted Mandy's grip, ever so slightly. Ah, yes, he said. You've done a little of this, I see. Mandy sort of shrugged. No big deal for him. The novice in the room had already been spotted. And then we went to work. The first day was devoted to the most basic body mechanics, starting with the proper stance. Mastery wasn't really the goal. There wasn't enough time for that. Rather, it would have to be the illusion of mastery, and that could only be achieved by adhering to the fundamentals of fencing. How to stand, where to place your arms and feet. How to hold your free hand, not clenched, but relaxed, something I had a hard time perfecting. A professional fencer, they explained, could watch a sword fighting sequence on film and tell immediately if the actors involved were complete amateurs. The easiest to spot were when the actors or stuntmen could be seen just hitting the swords back and forth over and over in the same manner, the way kids do with sticks. They explained that they had requested that the fight sequences be filmed late in the production, allowing us a few weeks of intense daily training and prep, followed by a few months of training while on location. Bob then pointed out that although it wasn't possible for either of us to become an Olympic-caliber fencer in that amount of time, maybe with the help and guidance of both himself and Peter, we might just be capable of fooling all but the most discerning of viewers. Their reputations were at stake as well, after all, he pointed out.
Mandy Patinkin. I went to London and began working with Bob Anderson, training religiously with him every day. Carrie and I were in different scenes often, so he would be filming and I would be free to train with Bob for 8 to 10 hours a day. And then I would be filming and Carrie would be free to train 8 to 10 hours a day. We'd meet each other at lunchtime to practice together. And we did this for 4 months of the filming, and all the fencing sequences, for the most part, were placed toward the end of the movie so that we would have the optimum amount of time to prepare.
Learning the posture of fencing is rather like calisthenics, they explained. You have to have very strong legs, and in particular thighs, as it's your thighs you have to train to get the stance correctly. If you don't, then it all just turns to mush, Peter said. You have to rest on your haunches, with your knees slightly bent at all times, but with your back straight and your legs spread apart, one foot facing one way and the other foot facing the other, so that you're able to go backward and forward at any given time. Almost like a crab, and it's far more stiff and uncomfortable than you might imagine. By noon on the first day, I was silently screaming in my head for a lunch break, and not because I was particularly hungry, but because the muscles in my very core, ones I didn't even know I possessed, throbbed in agony. I was covered in sweat in no time, Mandy only slightly less so. "Keep your left hand in the air," Peter said, referring to my free hand. "Your right wrist has to be relaxed and free. You should never be tense. If you feel tense, you will look tense." I listened carefully and tried to follow every direction, but as any athlete can tell you, things begin to break down when the mind is willing but the body is unable. My abdominal muscles cried out in pain, as if I'd done 1,000 sit-ups. My calves and thighs burned as if I'd climbed 100 stairs.
Back and forth," Peter instructed.
I scurried across the room, shuffling awkwardly from one wall to the other. The idea was simply to become acquainted with the motion. I was told not to worry about the sword so much at this point, to just hold it aloft and not even think about doing anything with it for now. All of that would come later. The weapon, they explained, would eventually become an extension of my arm. Of course, merely holding the sword for that amount of time was exhausting. Every couple of minutes, Peter would tell me to stop and adjust my grip or stance. Then we'd do it some more. Later that afternoon, we were treated to a rather extraordinary little show.
We're going to show you what fencing really looks like, Bob said. Mandy and I were ordered to the side of the studio while he and Peter took positions opposite one another and began to duel. It was an incredible sight to behold. They moved at lightning speed, and the fact that they waited until we were both tired and feeling utterly inept was a stroke of professional genius, as it greatly enhanced our appreciation for the skill and dexterity on display. Had their demonstration come at the beginning of the day, before I'd had an opportunity to fumble around a bit with weaponry, I might not have fully appreciated what I was seeing. But now, while my muscles were aching and my frustration building, I could not possibly have been more impressed. I looked at Mandy. He looked back and smiled. Very quietly, I mouthed, "Wow." He nodded in agreement. I think we may have even applauded when they finished. Bob then explained that what we had just witnessed was a finely tuned version of the first of many sequences they hoped to teach us. The first of many? How many? Here's what we're going to do, Bob said, looking at me. After we train you for a while, we're going to flip it around and I'll teach you Mandy's moves. Okay. Then Peter is going to teach Mandy all of your moves. You are basically going to learn each other's moves as well, so there can be no room for error. Another pause. A hard look in the eye, teacher to student. All clear? Again, I looked at Mandy. We nodded in unison. The amount of creative freedom that had been given to Bob and Peter was both remarkable and logical. Apart from the statement by Goldman that this was to be the greatest sword fight in modern times, and the references to the period techniques, there was in fact limited stage direction in his script, while Wesley and Indigo clamber up and down rocks and engage in witty repartee. With those six words as their guiding principle, and keeping in mind the twist at the middle, where both combatants reveal that they had been dueling with their weaker hands, Peter and Bob had virtually free rein to choreograph a fight that would hopefully be remembered as one of the best ever put on the silver screen. Fortunately, they were more than up to the task. Over lunch that day, we chatted about movies and the role of stuntmen and stunt coordinators. That was when Mandy and I began to learn of their past work on film and TV. As Bob and Peter related tales of working with Errol Flynn, Burt Lancaster, Sean Connery, Alec Guinness, and Harrison Ford, our enthusiasm and respect grew immeasurably. Bob then explained that in order for us to succeed in pulling off the sequence, the duel had to be convincing from both an aesthetic and athletic standpoint. In short, it had to look like the real deal. He further pointed out that Rob's goal from the very beginning was to film a scene in which the actors themselves appeared in every frame of the fight, as opposed to using stunt doubles. This was ambitious. After all, as Peter pointed out, even Lancaster, Flynn, and Fairbanks on occasion let the real fencing masters do the most challenging work. Gulp again. They both suggested we do homework by watching some of the best swashbuckling movies Hollywood had produced, such as The Black Pirate, The Adventures of Robin Hood, The Seahawk, etc., so that we could study them and absorb the artistry and athleticism. And all the while, remember, we're going to do it even better. We're going to create the sword fight to end all sword fights, Bob stated confidently. And as we teach you how to fight, as we go through the training, you'll begin to see how they broke down their sequences in those films, Peter explained. And he was absolutely right. Watching one of these movies prior to training was a completely different experience from watching it after we began working with Peter and Bob. I could actually see how and what they had practiced. I could see where they made mistakes and where they sort of flubbed part of the fight. Our assignment was to find these mistakes and point them out to our instructors. After lunch, we went into separate studios, as we would do for the next few weeks before going on location. I practiced with Peter and Mandy with Bob. It was trial and error, starting and stopping each time I made a mistake, which was frequently. It was rather like doing a movie scene. If you made a mistake, you stop and go back to the beginning. And Peter made me do it over and over until I got it right. It was a matter of repetition, like studying lines in a script. There were no shortcuts. One just had to keep working at it until it became second nature. Scripted fighting is very much like the choreography of a dance. Two partners working with each other in an attempt to create something perfectly synchronized. In a scripted fight, though, there is the added element of competition. The audience is supposed to believe that the two combatants are really trying to hurt each other. To that end, the actors must legitimately fight, all the while knowing how the battle will end. There are a few very basic universal moves, and Mandy and I had to learn these first before doing anything else. The first of these was essentially how to defend yourself. For example, to deflect a hit, we had to think of our swords as an extension of our hands. So, if I'm looking at my opponent, and I've got my fist holding the sword directly in front of my face, and my opponent tries to strike the right side of my head as a swipe, as if to cut my neck sideways, my deflective maneuver is to move my arm to the right as the swipe approaches. My sword is then up and effectively blocks my opponent's blade. It looks rather dramatic and potentially lethal, but really all I've done is move my sword a few inches to one side in anticipation of what I know is coming, much as you would move your arm or hand if someone was trying to hit you from that angle. On the other hand, if my opponent tries to cut my thigh or stomach, instead of moving my fist straight up and to the right, I just flip the sword downward and do the same thing. If he tries to cut my left flank, I move to the left, and so on. Obviously, this takes some coordination to avoid accident or injury, but with time and practice, they assured us, it would become routine. Economy of movement is paramount, they said. It should all look more dangerous and difficult than it really is.
Mandy Patinkin. I recently did a vaudeville show, and there is a language to that, as there is in various sports and dance, etc. If I do this step, then you do that step, or we do it together, and you just learn that language. Our sword fight was the same way. You make certain moves toward me, and there are a variety of responses I can make. But it's limited. It's not infinite.
And so we practiced each one of these maneuvers maybe hundreds of times that very first day. Start working your wrist, Peter said after a while. Remember, be fluid. There is something zen-like about fencing, he said. Kind of like letting your sword almost guide you. You mean like using the force? I asked, making a reference to his work on that film. If you like, yes, came the quick response. And always watch your opponent's eyes, he said. Don't look at his sword. If you watch his sword, you'll make a mistake. If you watch his eyes, however, you will know what his next maneuver is going to be, as he will telegraph it. All I could think of was Bruce Lee's line from Enter the Dragon when he slaps his student on the head with a warning, never take your eyes off your opponent. I found it interesting that we did not wear protective gear of any sort while we were training, no gloves or chest protectors or face masks. Yes, the tips of our blades were covered, but they were still quite capable of gouging an eye from its socket or injuring you in some fashion if wielded recklessly. To drive that point home, Peter at one point whipped me across the ribcage with his rapier. I winced, stifling a little whimper. Did you feel that? He asked, although I think he knew the answer. A little, I lied. Good, he said. Remember that. That's what can happen if you're not paying attention. I felt like Grasshopper in the TV series Kung Fu. He was right. This was very zen-like training. All joking aside, Peter and Bob were intense and serious about their work. It was clear they weren't messing around. They wanted to make sure that we got the point, so to speak. As the first day came to a close, with Mandy and I both thoroughly exhausted by this point, our trainers then offered what amounted to an honest assessment. Obviously, the key moment in this sequence, Bob said, is when you have to change from being right-handed to left-handed. To be perfectly honest, we're not sure that we can teach you to be left-hand proficient in time. We just wanted you to know that. We've told that to the producers and to Rob. You can't teach someone to fight left-handed in this short space of time and have them be totally professional. He stopped, looked over at Peter. So we will probably have to have stunt doubles standing by if need be, just in case. In retrospect, I wonder if this was the complete truth or merely a motivational ploy on their part. Certainly it had the latter effect, particularly on Mandy, who said almost without hesitation, "Don't worry, we'll get it." The room was quiet for a moment. Mandy looked at me. What was I going to do? Did I think a stunt double might be necessary to stage the greatest sword fight in modern times? Of course, it occurred to me that it might not be a bad idea after Bob had suggested it. Was I going to admit that now, seconds after Mandy had promised no such assistance was necessary? No frigging way. Sure, I said. We can do it. That night, as I shuffled around my room on my aching joints and muscles, I wondered what I'd gotten myself into. I could barely fight with my right hand. How the heck was I ever going to learn to do it all with my left? I could barely walk or lift anything. The second day of training, less than 12 hours later, was even worse. I spent the whole morning resting on my haunches, trying to ignore the burning in my legs.
"Told you it might be a bit stiff," Peter said with a smile.
About an hour into training, I had stopped focusing on the stiffness and had moved on to severe doubt and dread. Not dread as in Dread Pirate Roberts, but real dread. Fear was creeping in. Could I really do this? Even though I had the finest teachers in the world and a co-star whose unwavering commitment pushed me to a level I thought unattainable, I began to realize that the art of fencing is exponentially more difficult to master than it appears to be. And if you're completely new to this, even if you're training several hours a day to achieve at least the appearance of proficiency, it's almost impossible. I don't care if you're the fittest guy on the planet with the dexterity of Yoda. I may be many things, but I am certainly not a quitter. So I kept going to the studio day after day, and thankfully, after a while, things began to get a little easier. Slowly but surely, my muscles adjusted to the tasks expected of them. Inadequacy began to give way to competency. Peter and Bob broke everything down to minutiae. We'd train and train, learning one sequence at a time. They'd teach us the first five moves, then another five moves, then another set, and so on and so forth, until we finally had the basic outline of the whole fight. After a while, I started to gain more confidence, perhaps even becoming a little cocky. It's a natural thing, I suppose, in any sporty endeavor, especially one that involves combat. I wanted to show off for my mentors, maybe even prove myself worthy of their respect. "Come on, show me what you've got," I'd say to Peter. Inevitably, after that brazen comment, there would then be a quick flash of silver, the sound of metal clinking against metal, and I'd be suddenly standing there unarmed, my sword having been swept from my hand and deposited on the floor in what felt like less time than it takes to draw a single breath. As if I needed reminding, this was humbling proof that either one of these men, despite being three decades older, could kick my butt at a moment's notice. And so it went for 2.5 weeks. Mandy and I could not develop much camaraderie during this time because for the most part they kept us separated. Every so often they would bring him into the studio where I was training with Peter and say, "Okay, let's see you try it with each other. Just the first sequence." Then we'd practice a couple of times, make a few mistakes, and they'd separate us again. At the end of each day, I would drive home, bathe my aching muscles in a hot bath, have a bite to eat, and work on the script. I'd devoured it cover to cover a few times already, and loved it more and more with each successive reading, but I hadn't really begun memorizing all my lines. I tried a few times, but the day's fencing efforts proved too draining. As soon as I curled up on the sofa and began looking at the words, even with the best intentions, I'd crash, having learned only a couple of scenes. In the last few days before the start of principal photography, Bob and Peter explained that we'd only skimmed the surface. The training would go on every day during the shoot. Unlike the other actors, we would not have the luxury of any downtime. "If you have a single free moment, we're putting a sword in your hand," they promised. And they weren't kidding. They were on the set every day, lurking in the shadows, waiting for an opportunity to grab Mandy or me. They figured logically that if the fight training was put off until the end of the day's shoot, we'd be too tired to give it much of an effort. So instead, they would stand behind the camera and wait like hawks. As soon as a new setup was called for, which opened a 10-minute window in the schedule, Peter would appear out of nowhere, rapiers in hand.
"Come on, let's go. No time to waste."
As a result, Mandy and I hardly ever sat down during the entire production. While the other actors were hanging out and generally having a good time, we were working on our fight sequence, day in and day out. For me, it was the equivalent of a graduate-level course in professional fencing from two masters. I will never forget it, and I am forever grateful. Chapter 5. Wrestling ROUSs in the Fire Swamp. My first day of filming on The Princess Bride was also the first day of shooting, August 18th, 1986. Mandy and I had finished training at 5 o'clock the previous evening, and a call sheet was delivered to the dance studio. I remember both of us getting words of encouragement from Bob and Peter as we left that afternoon, as well as assurances that they would be with us both every step of the way over the next few months. On the way back to my hotel, I looked over the call sheet and saw there was a 5:45 a.m. pickup to go to the studio. I then looked over the filming schedule. For the first few weeks, Robin and I would be filming the scenes in the fire swamp on H stage at Shepperton, the same set I had already visited with Rob while it was still under construction. I recall sitting in my hotel room later, going over my scenes for the next day, and feeling just a tad anxious. Even though this wasn't my first studio movie, it was certainly the biggest. A lot was riding on my being able to pull this character off. Yes, I had studied the book ad nauseam, which was now crammed full of my notes. I'd also gone over the script and done my usual notations in that too. Nevertheless, I started feeling a little self-doubt. After all, aren't all actors a bit insecure, as Bill and Rob have stated? So was I suffering from a case of good old pre-game butterflies? Sure, I'll admit it. And to be fair, it was perfectly understandable given the circumstances. This was probably the most important role of my career. If I screwed it up, it would be a while before I would be offered another. To quote Mr. Goldman from his book, Which Lie Did I Tell? This is not a book about my neuroses. Well, maybe it is, but anyway, I will cut to the chase. I decided to call Rob over at the Dorchester. I knew that chatting with him would put me at ease. Of course, I didn't come right out and admit that I was in any way nervous. Instead, I called under the guise of curiosity. "Hiya, Carrie. How you doing?" "Great, thanks," I said, trying to sound confident, even though I don't think he bought it. "How about you?" "Great. How's the fencing coming along?"
"Good," I said. "Peter and Bob are incredible teachers."
"They're pretty great, aren't they?"
Rob said.
"We're all very excited to see what you guys have done."
He went on to say that the plan was for Mandy and I to rehearse a version of the duel for him on the actual set once it was completed, so we could get a feel for the terrain. That didn't really concern me, though. There were other things on my mind. "So, what can we expect tomorrow?" I asked, getting straight to the point.
"We're starting out with a fairly simple scene,"
Rob said, his voice brimming with excitement, just like a little kid.
"You know, the one where you reveal how you became the Dread Pirate Roberts to Buttercup while you carry her through the swamp. Then all you gotta do is save Robin from the fire."
Saving Robin from a fire didn't sound all that simple.
"Does that involve stunt work?" I asked.
"A couple of stunts," Rob went on. "But the stunt guys told me it's all pretty basic stuff."
"Really?"
"Yeah, I mean, like I said, one of them involves some fire, but they've assured me it's no big deal."
"Okay, cool." Which is precisely how I was trying to sound.
"Yeah, and the only other thing is you guys are going to be sinking into some quicksand."
Fire? Quicksand? This was Rob's idea of basic stuff?
"All right, that sounds like fun," I replied, trying to sound as upbeat as possible. I took a second, then finally let out what was on my mind. "I just want to make sure I get him right, you know?" Rob had been down this road enough times himself to recognize the tone of a restless actor when he heard one. I remember he replied in a very compassionate way.
"Carrie, you don't have to worry. You're him. You got him without even knowing it. It's all there inside of you."
Then he said something else I'll never forget about the tone he wanted to strike with the characters.
"The important thing to remember, and this is what I've been telling everybody, is that even though I want you guys to have fun, I don't want you to play it for the laughs, you know what I mean?"
"Yeah, you want us to play it straight."
"Exactly, because Bill's writing is so brilliant, you don't have to tip anything. The words alone will make people laugh. It's all right there on the page. So like I said, you don't have to worry about a thing, okay? You're gonna be fine, trust me."
I then thanked him and bid him goodnight before hanging up. Despite Rob's very honest reassurances, I couldn't help staying up late, poring over the next day's scenes over and over again, making sure that I didn't miss anything. That is, until I finally fell asleep from sheer exhaustion. The next morning, I woke up early and went straight to the studio, eager to get to my first day at work, on time and well prepared. I was ushered by the first AD into the hair and makeup department, where I met with Lois Burwell, our incredibly talented makeup artist, who had worked on a couple of my favorite films, The Draftsman's Contract and Mona Lisa, and has since become a personal favorite of Mr. Spielberg's. Lois was going to be applying not only my makeup, but also a little fake mustache on me a few weeks into filming. This was something Rob and I had agreed on for the look of Wesley, a pencil-thin one, which I told Rob would give him a very Flynn Fairbanks flair if I could grow it in time. I was able to grow one, but I would have to shave it off, as we were filming the farm boy scenes with Buttercup out of sequence, which called for me to be clean-shaven, thus the need for the fake one. While Lois was making me up, our equally professional hairstylist, Jan Jameson,
who had incidentally worked with Mandy on Yentl, started applying a small ponytail to the back of my head, another look that Rob and I had discussed for Wesley. This process involved using incredibly painful tiny rubber bands that had to be placed close to my scalp so that she could weave the hair in. It wasn't her fault they hurt, though. Jan assured me that, given all the stunt work I would have to do, this backfall, as it was called, was the only way to apply it to my head. After getting made up, I headed over to my dressing room on the lot. There, hanging on the wall, greeting me as I walked in, was the full Man in Black costume. Leaning on a chair next to it, I noticed my actual movie sword for the first time. As I took it out of its scabbard, it glistened in the morning light. It had been designed by a professional sword maker, as had all the swords in the movie, to Bob and Peter's specifications. I practiced a few moves to get the hang of it. It was beautifully crafted and very lightweight. Once I finished getting dressed, I checked myself in the mirror in my full outfit one last time. This was it. Time to bring the Dread Pirate Roberts to life. I hooked my scabbard to my belt and grabbed my gloves and mask. Before I had a chance for a second thought, there was a knock on the door. It was a production assistant, a job I had once held, now there to bring me to the stage. I opened the door and let him in. "Are you ready?" he asked. "Ready as I'll ever be," I replied, grabbing my sides. Just walking onto the set itself was an incredible experience. I'd never seen such a large crew. All the producers were there, along with the heads of all the departments. Bill Goldman was also there, chatting with one of the producers, Steve Nicolaides. Everything about the setting screamed big-time Hollywood movie. What I felt could be akin to the thrill that perhaps a minor league baseball player experiences when he's called up to the majors and walks into a 50,000-seat stadium for the first time. I felt a palpable sense of awe and excitement. In the theater, unlike film, you have a sense of the finished product even as you are rehearsing. And you get to tell the entire story every night. Movie making is a completely different process. It's about shepherding actors, craftsmen, and technicians, artists all, in the pursuit of a common goal, trying to catch lightning in a bottle. A goal that can seem painfully elusive at times, depending on the circumstances. Films are cobbled together over weeks and months, with scenes captured from multiple angles and points of view, and under a myriad of conditions. A single scene or sequence, depending on how large it is, can sometimes take a couple of days to shoot, in some cases weeks, as was the case for the infamous duel in the Fire Swamp. Adding to the disorientation is the fact that nearly everything is filmed out of sequence, ergo the need for my fake mustache. There can be no doubt that a certain childlike wonder is required to do the job, but actors also need an abundance of patience and flexibility, as things don't always turn out as planned. All I know is that I love working in film, and aside from being with my family, I wouldn't rather be anywhere else in the world than on a movie set. There really is nothing to compare it to. Standing across from me, getting wired by the sound department, was Robin, looking radiant as ever in Buttercup's bright red dress. After sharing some nice compliments about our respective outfits, I too began to get wired. This is where the sound department hides a small microphone on your person, much like you see in the movies when the FBI or the police need to have someone wear a wire in order to catch the bad guy incriminating himself. The reason for this is so the sound department can pick up even the faintest dialogue that may be too quiet or soft to be picked up by the boom microphone. While Phyllis and the boom operator tried to figure out where the best place to hide the mic would be on my costume, I looked around and noticed Goldman standing off to the side of the set, all by himself. As at the table reading, he appeared to be even more nervous and excited than I was. More unduly anxious than usual, I should say. I remembered his words at the read-through, where he stated that he might seem a little so, because this was his favorite piece of work. I couldn't tell if it was that, or maybe it was because it was the first day of shooting. I should point out, though, that this was not Goldman's first time at the rodeo. He had spent some time on the sets of Marathon Man, Butch Cassidy, All the President's Men, and A Bridge Too Far. However, even though he visited these sets, he never stayed for the whole shoot. This was not a rare thing in Hollywood back then or even nowadays. The norm is that unless rewrites are needed on the fly, the screenwriter is rarely invited to the shoot, except for perhaps a customary visit to meet everyone. He often ends up watching the rest of the production from afar, as his baby is nurtured by someone else. Some directors feel a little insecure about having the writer on location, perhaps fearful that they might be judging their methods or vision. If changes are needed, these directors usually prefer to have the new scenes or lines delivered by email or fax. For some, having a writer on the set is deemed at best a distraction, at worst, a nuisance. Some prefer to work with them at arm's length, unless, of course, the director is the writer, allowing the script to morph into something else entirely. And to be fair to those directors, this is not necessarily a bad thing. It's allowing the director to have creative license born of inspiration. I remember a writer who had written big studio movies telling me once, "There are three movies when you make a movie. The one you write, the one you guys shoot, and the one the director edits." For some writers, this kind of banishment can be considered heresy. For others, it's no big deal. Neither one of them is necessarily right or wrong. It's just one of those challenging dynamics, whether the director feels comfortable having the writer around or not. It's really up to their discretion. Rob adored Bill and had such admiration for his talent that he invited him on the set not just for a visit, but for the duration of the production. Indeed, we all felt that way about Bill. To us, he was such a giant, not only within the industry, but also within the artistic community at large, that we were all in awe of him. He was also then, and still is, a very genteel, big-hearted guy. You'd have to be to write a fairy tale love story for your kids. So there was never a question about whether he should be there with us or not. This was, after all, his favorite screenplay. Why wouldn't he be invited? Although I got the distinct sense from him that he really didn't want to be there.
William Goldman. I don't like being on set. If you're a screenwriter, it's boring. The words are all done, and they're doing the movie, and your work is done. I don't like being around. I never wanted to direct. I don't know how to talk to actors. Most of them are half phony. So I don't like being on a movie set. Never have. I mean, I like being there for the reading, because there is work to be done, and you can hear it being performed. But I just don't like being around the shoot, so I wasn't there much. But overall, it was still the best experience of my whole life.
The first scene on the first day was the one in which Wesley leads Buttercup through the fire swamp, hacking away at vines while relating to both Buttercup and the audience how he came to be the man in black. The fire swamp, incidentally, is described as follows in the stage directions of Bill's script. It really doesn't look any worse than any other moist, sulfurous, infernal horror you might run across. Great trees block the sun. And that's exactly what it looked like. It was now completely covered in creepers and vines and had large toadstools and moss-covered rocks all over the place. My first line of dialogue describing my thoughts about the swamp to make Buttercup feel secure was, "You know, it's not that bad. I'm not saying I'd like to build a summer home here, but the trees are actually quite lovely." I recall not getting it quite right. Rob had a very specific idea about how the word summer home should be pronounced and thought I was putting too much emphasis on the second word as opposed to the first.
Billy Crystal.
Rob is incredibly smart about material and so freeing for actors to do their best work. And it's always about timing. It's about the music of it. And for that movie, no one had better timing than Rob. And this movie he particularly loved, and it shows. It's a beautiful film, and it's because of Rob.
"It's summer home, Carrie," Rob said.
"Right, summer home."
"No, try it again. Summer home."
We tried a second take, and then something strange happened. Before I even got to finish the line, an odd look came across Rob's face from behind the monitor. He turned to Andy Scheinman, lifted off his headphones, and said,
"What's that weird noise I can hear?"
Andy removed his headphones as well and shook his head. "I don't know, but I can hear it too."
"Cut!" Rob yelled.
Rob turned to our sound guy, David John.
"Dave, what's that weird noise?"
he asked.
"I don't know, but it's stopped now," came the reply from David.
We rolled again, and once again, right in the middle of a take, Rob yelled cut.
"What the heck is that?"
Rob asked again, walking over to the sound cart. Our now frustrated sound man rewound the tape and let them all listen to it again to see if they could decipher what it was and thus, hopefully, where it was coming from. The tape was played back, and even I got a listen. You could clearly hear what sounded like some sort of strange incantation or chanting of some kind. It was barely audible, but it was definitely on the soundtrack. The ADs spread out and began searching the swamp, listening for the sound. I think it was Rob who eventually discovered Bill standing behind a giant toadstool, rocking back and forth with his fingers crossed in his mouth, mumbling under his breath.
Bill, what are you doing?
Rob asked quizzically. Embarrassed, Bill stammered as he removed his hands from his mouth.
Oh, I was just praying. Why?
You can't talk on the set, Bill, not while we're filming. The microphones pick up everything.
Bill lowered his head.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry, he said. I was just a little excited, I guess.
Rob threw an arm around him and pulled him close.
It's okay, Bill, just relax.
Rob Reiner.
Bill was there during the early scenes. I remember he was freaking out the first day he was there. He would get behind the camera and he'd turn his back and he would kind of cross his fingers. And it was kind of a weird thing, almost like a little kid who was hoping everything would go well.
Rob then turned to us and calmly said, "Okay, let's try it again." The next two takes were printed, but apparently I still could not get the delivery of Summerholm exactly right. When a director gives a line reading to an actor, when he demonstrates precisely how the word should be spoken, it can sometimes be a bit awkward. But Rob's personality is so engaging and his demeanor so unthreatening that he is just naturally able to put an actor at ease. He also knows exactly how it should sound. The next take, I finally got it right. Afterward, I said to Rob, "You know, in England, we don't really have summer homes, given the climate." He laughed and said, "Yeah, that figures." For the next sequence in the fire swamp, there would be no easing into things. This would be a baptism by fire. Although the stunts and special effects in The Princess Bride were certainly modest by today's standards, and indeed even by the standards of some of the Hollywood blockbusters of the time, e.g. Star Wars and Indiana Jones trilogies, they nevertheless represented my introduction to the technological possibilities of movie making and the risks and challenges associated with stunt work. This was the point in the fire swamp sequence where Buttercup's dress briefly catches on fire before the flame is extinguished by Wesley. It's merely a line in the stage directions and consumes only a few seconds of film. But before we could shoot the scene, several steps had to be taken. First, a fire marshal had to be brought to the set. He would then meet with the stunt coordinator, Peter Diamond, Nick Alder, our FX supervisor, and his special effects crew. This was followed by what is known as a general safety meeting with the rest of the crew. Anytime there are firearms, fire, or even a dangerous or semi-dangerous stunt involved, there is always a safety meeting of this kind. The whole crew gathers around, and usually the first AD explains what the meeting is about. He then introduces everyone to the person in charge of special effects, stunts, firearms, etc., and that person walks everyone through the sequence, detailing both process and all potential safety concerns. And that is what happened that day, as Nick filled us in. We were all then invited to walk around the set as he pointed out various places on the ground through which flames would periodically spurt. Each point had been marked by a bright orange rubber street cone.
"Please make sure you don't step on any of these gas outlets," he cautioned. "Always walk around them. That's why we have put cones next to each one, so you can all familiarize yourself with where the flames are going to come from. There's another one over there, and there's another one there. There are three of them in all, and we're going to time these to go off a certain way. Just so you guys will know exactly when the flames are going to spurt, we have arranged for the sound of air to be blasted through the pipes containing the gas beforehand as a warning. Okay?"
We all nodded.
"Okay, the last one, right here," he said, pointing to a cone, "is going to be the one that sets fire to Robin's dress."
I looked over at Robin. She betrayed not the slightest bit of concern. "We've had a special dress made for her," he continued, "that is made out of flame-retardant material." Rob then turned to Robin and said, "Robin, you're okay with this, right?" I've done enough movies in the last 25 years to know that this is always a difficult moment for an actor. Actors nearly always want to appear courageous and committed, willing to do anything for the team. So while it is perfectly acceptable to opt out of a stunt and let the professionals handle it, there is some pressure, mostly internal, to push yourself beyond your normal comfort zone. Typically, the director will follow up after the consultation with the stunt coordinator and special effects experts and the actors just to make sure everyone is at ease with their respective roles when it comes to the stunt. Certainly that was the case on this occasion, as Rob consulted with both Robin and me about our willingness to do the stunt. But more so with her, seeing as she was the one who was actually going to be set on fire.
"If you don't want to do it, it's totally fine," Rob assured her. "We got the doubles, so it's okay. We can shoot around you."
Robin looked at me. I shrugged. "If you're game, so am I." She then turned back to Rob. "No, I think we can do this." Rob glanced at me.
"Are you guys sure?"
"Absolutely," I chimed in. "I'll make sure she's safe.
Let's give it a shot.
We carefully watched the scene rehearse with our stunt doubles, Andy Bradford for me, Sue Crossland for Robin, so we could study in detail what would be required of us. As Nick had warned us, each little burst of flame was preceded by a loud whoosh sound as a thick blast of oxygen was shot out of the gas pipe, so we always knew precisely when and where the actual flame would appear. At the appointed time, we watched as Sue's flame-retardant dress caught on fire and Andy put it out. So, from what I could gather, Robin was essentially going to be set on fire, and my job was to grab her, move her away from the open flame, and then extinguish the fire on her dress without letting her get burned in any way. No biggie, right? All you have to do is rub the dress together, and the retardant will put the fire out by itself, Nick instructed. However, if it looks like there's a problem, just step aside immediately, and Peter and myself will douse her with a fire extinguisher. We'll be right here next to the camera. It's only a small flame, so it shouldn't spread. Was I apprehensive about shooting a scene that involved an unstable element on another actor? Especially fire? You bet. It occurred to me that even though Robin was wearing a full layer of fireproof clothing beneath her flame-retardant dress, her face and hands would still be exposed. Interestingly, the stunt coordinators and the FX team told her that if anything went wrong, she was to immediately cover her face with her hands, which would have been the natural knee-jerk reaction anyway. Did I do my best to hide my anxiety at being the one to put out the fire on Robin? You bet correctly again. So we lined up for the shot, and Rob yelled, "Action!" and I walked Robin past the last fire pit. There was a whooshing sound, and then the flame. And it was a pretty large burst of flame, I can tell you. It caught me by surprise. Obviously, Robin's dress immediately caught fire, but just as I pulled her aside to extinguish it, there came a loud yell from behind the camera. Rob called for cut. What was the commotion this time? It turns out that even though Bill knew exactly what was going to happen, as he had written this sequence into every version of the screenplay, he had apparently forgotten that this particular stunt was being shot that day and had left the set for some reason, missing the safety meeting, and returned right in the middle of the first take. As soon as he saw Robin on fire, he naturally thought that there had been some sort of an accident. Thus, he yelled out something to the effect of, "Oh my God, her dress is on fire! She's on fire!" effectively ruining another take. After yelling cut, Rob calmly turned to Goldman and said, "Bill, it's supposed to catch on fire, remember?" Fortunately, everything went smoothly, and I was able to put out the fire without too much difficulty, each and every take thereafter. I remember Robin's reaction when the large flame caught on her dress was a very small ooh, rather than a scream, which should tell you just how unfazed she was by it all. Or just how good an actress she was at hiding her fear.
Robin Wright.
I remember on one take the dress caught fire and it kept catching fire. I don't know if they forgot to put fire retardant on part of the dress. Anyway, it just kept burning and burning and burning, and thankfully Carrie put it out just as it was crawling up toward my long hair.
William Goldman. I remember turning to Rob and saying, "You're setting fire to Robin on the first day? What are you, nuts? It's not like we can replace her." Rob Reiner.
We were in the fire swamp and shooting the scene where a burst of flame catches Robin's dress on fire. And Bill was really upset, saying, "I can't believe that on the first day of shooting, we're setting the leading lady on fire."
As soon as Rob yelled cut after each take, the FX crew and Peter would rush over and douse her with a small fire extinguisher just to be sure. And she would have to change into a succession of dresses once the burn became noticeable. Bill was so embarrassed at having potentially ruined another take, he wanted to book his flight home right away. But Rob convinced him to stay longer. He actually made it to the first day of shooting for the Florin Castle sequences at Haddon Hall before packing his things and leaving. The reason I remember is because I brought a video camera to the set that day and shot some behind-the-scenes footage that included him. And then, the very next day, he left. Just like that. The man responsible for creating this wondrous world, this magical story, was gone. Fortunately, he would return later. Setting fire to Robin was just the first of a couple of challenging physical sequences to be undertaken in the swamp. Before the day ended, there was another meeting with the FX crew, this time to discuss Buttercup's disappearance into what looks like quicksand, referred to as snow sand in the book, and her subsequent rescue by Wesley. Again, the entire sequence was explained and demonstrated by the special effects team and by Peter Diamond in a safety meeting. Located just a few inches beneath the quicksand, we were told, was a trapdoor made out of latex and plywood that was being held in place by a member of the FX team. When Buttercup stepped on the appropriate spot at the appropriate time, the door would be released and she would be sucked into the sand. Shortly after she disappeared, I was to jump in after her, using the same technique. Beneath the trapdoor was a pit filled with foam mattresses to ensure that the person falling down would land safely. Peter and the stunt team assured us that they would be down there to catch us and make sure we weren't injured. A marvelous and very effective illusion. Our doubles, Andy and Sue, began walking us through the stunt effortlessly and safely. As with the fire stunt, they would do one take, and then it was to be our turn. In all honesty, this one seemed easy, at least in comparison to the previous stunt. But after watching, there was something about it that seemed a little odd. My initial instructions were to merely walk in after Robin, grab my nose with one hand to prevent sand from getting in it, and jump down feet first. But when we looked at the scene on playback afterwards, it seemed kind of feeble. There was something rather unheroic about jumping into quicksand feet first, especially holding one's nose. "I don't know, guys," I said. "It doesn't exactly seem swashbuckling, does it? What if I were to dive in head first?" Rob agreed, but both he and the stunt team were reluctant to let me, or anyone for that matter, dive headfirst into the pit. It was much too dangerous. What if I got injured? It hadn't really been designed or tested for that purpose, they reasoned quite correctly. I tried to plead my case. What sort of fairy tale hero would watch his love tumble into a pit of quicksand and then take time to place his sword and sheath on the ground and just sort of step casually into the pit to save her? No one disputed the idea, but there were legitimate safety concerns and insurance issues that had to be considered. The fear, naturally, was that a mistimed headlong dive into the quicksand could result in serious injury, like a broken neck, spinal injury, or fractured skull, and thus the termination of the entire movie. There was quite a lot at stake. But then that's often the case with any special effects or stunt work. As the relative freshman on the set, it wasn't easy for me to voice my opinion about something that was not just a matter of safety, but also a matter of artistic license. But I instinctively knew that stepping into the quicksand didn't seem right, that it wasn't graceful enough to capture the spirit of the story or the character. I didn't think Wesley was the type of person who would be too timid to dive headfirst into quicksand to save his true love. It didn't seem true to his nature. I wanted him to be consistent with Goldman's vision, at once fearless and elegant, romantic and brave. My theory was that if he wasn't afraid to throttle a giant, wrestle humongous rats, and defeat Inigo Montoya in a duel, he shouldn't be afraid to dive headlong into quicksand. "There's going to be some exciting music here, right?" I asked Rob. "Yeah, sure." "Then let's give Wesley some exciting behavior to go along with it." After a lot of beard scratching, Rob finally relented. "Okay, but not with you, with your stunt double," was his only concession. This was a big deal for me. It was the first moment in which I felt like a real collaborator in the process, not merely a hired hand. I had earned the trust and respect of a director I greatly admired. I pulled Andy Bradford aside. "Do you think you can do it?" "Absolutely," he said without hesitation. "No problem." Andy was not someone who showed fear at all. Peter Diamond then talked Andy through the sequence and how to do it safely. They stood around the pit, miming the dive, discussing proper timing, and then, with the cameras rolling, first Robin disappeared. Then Andy, bless his heart, after grabbing a piece of vine he had hacked, dove right in after her. He had never practiced the stunt before, and he did it perfectly. The trapdoor opened, and he slid smoothly into the sand, looking very heroic in the process. When he made his way back to the surface with Robin on his back and using the vine for support, there was a big applause from us all. Everyone had become convinced of the merits of diving rather than walking into the quicksand. "That was great, Andy. Carrie, you think you can do that?" Rob asked excitedly. "I think so," I replied. He then turned to Andy. "Can you show him? That was fantastic!" Andy spit out a few grains of sand and smiled. "Yeah, sure." Unlike Andy, the special effects folks went along reluctantly. They were naturally nervous that the door might not open at the precise moment, because if it didn't, I was warned, then I would be smashing my skull against plywood with the full weight of my body.
"Just so you know, Governor," he said to Rob,
We're not liable. The trapdoor wasn't intended for this purpose, so we can't be certain it'll work a second time.